Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm thrilled to do this show. It's been one that I've had in mind for a couple of months, and at least the last two or three weeks, we've been working to get this amazing panel together on a day when they all are post-surgery enough, Doe Daughtry, or, of course, she's not feeling great today, but or just busy schedules to match up. But I'm so thrilled to have Doe Daughtry, Larry Mathley-Kipp, and Margaret Toscano on today. All three are wonderful scholars, two of them with mainly their focuses in religion, Margaret in classics, but as anyone would know about that period, the classical period of ancient Greece and Rome, religion and mythology and ritual and all those different things were just, just like the air that you breathe. And so she brings wonderful perspectives to the questions of religion. So I guess I forgot to say what the topic is. The topic we are going to do today, by the title you'll recognize it, is I'm going to call this Mormonism as a Religion. And to kind of tell you why that's not just like a big duh, I want to basically assert that I think what happens so much, and often with this audience, this kind of audience that's like generally finding Mormon Matters and Mormon Stories and these other things because somehow or other, just the way that they lived or swam in Mormonism at one point has become a little bit less comfortable for them, or they've begun to start to see it as something more than just beliefs. But I just wanted to make sure that we had a chance to full-on expand the view of what a religion is beyond just its beliefs and beyond, more specifically, the question of, is it true? Larry Mathley-Kipp, one of the reasons I've asked her to be on is she spoke at Sunstone in 2005 about Joseph Smith. It was our look at the, 200th anniversary of his birth and things like that. But she said there's so many interesting questions about Mormonism that we can ask other than, was Joseph Smith sincere when he claimed what he did? And so I know she brings lots of rich background to it, as everyone else does. So let's do quickly this. Let's introduce each other, and then we'll get rolling, and you'll catch on to what I mean by exploring us as a religion as we go. So, Doe Daughtry, I believe you're the only veteran of the Mormon Matters podcast on today. Would you quickly remind everybody about background, what you do, and thank you again for coming on when you're not feeling well.
I appreciate that. I'm a full-time instructor at Arizona State University Tempe campus. I teach lots of different kinds of courses, like religions of the world, ritual, symbol, and myth, witchcraft and heresy in Europe, women and religion, all kinds of sexy classes like that, and religion in America. I'm an Americanist, but both my master's thesis and my dissertation were about LDS women, so that's my main gig.
Well, great, but yeah, so we'll have you bring all those when you start a religion class for the semester, the kinds of stuff that you do to get things broadly framed at the beginning. We'll rely on you for that first, and then your Mormon expertise later, so thanks.
Okie doke.
Margaret Toscano, you're probably more familiar to our audience, I'm certain that you are, than Larry,
but
so we'll have her go last. Oh, please.
Yeah, I was going to say, you want me to go next?
Yeah.
Let me just tell you maybe some things that the audience wouldn't know.
Oh,
so
nice.
As you said, Dan, I am trained in classics, so I teach Latin and Greek. But I do a lot of research and teaching and publishing on myth and religion in the ancient world, But also, I did my doctoral dissertation on medieval women mystics.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I'm very much a comparatist. I do a lot of work with comparing different traditions. So I'm currently teaching a class about hell, where we look at hell not just as a religious belief, but also as a cultural pattern for dealing with issues of suffering and justice and evil and things like that. And I published a book about that. And then the audience may know more that I've been involved in Mormon studies for 40 years.
For sure.
And I published on Mormon feminism for 30 years, mostly in Mormon context, but I've done a few articles to a broader audience. For example, I published an article about women's experiences with the Heavenly Mother in a volume that dealt with spirituality. So I'm very much, I have broad concerns.
For sure. Well, I know you'd be great for all those reasons that you just mentioned. And I've just heard you speak, you know, because you come from a place of Mormonism as being certainly your home and your first language, and you're a wonderful theologian and things like that. But you've also felt, you know, stuff that we'll also talk about today, when religion turns on you, or when religion can kind of get magnified and pumped up in ways that, you know, people completely lose the forest for the trees, you know what I mean? Or they completely miss it and do violence to people. So
yeah, there is that dark side, right?
I'm just so thrilled to have you on and appreciate you so much. Laurie Mathley-Kipp, I've loved watching you as this wonderful. Are you the new Jan Chips? are you the new friendly to Mormon scholar who knows a lot about us, who sits on our committees, boards of journals and AAR groups and things like that. You've just been a wonderful friend and student of Mormonism, along with your many other interests. So, would you please just go crazy and introduce the heck out of yourself, and especially when it intersects with Mormonism.
Sure. Well, first, it's a pleasure to be with you all and to have this conversation. I have been studying religion a long time. I did my master's work and then my dissertation work, my PhD work in American history, in American religious history, but not Mormonism. That wasn't sort of the first thing I studied. I was a 19th century historian by training, and studied the history of the American West in particular, but came to Mormonism, I guess, about 15 years ago. I started teaching class on Mormonism at University of North Carolina, where I was then teaching, and taught Mormonism alongside a lot of other courses on American religious history, African American religion. I also taught a course there on theory and method in religious studies. So we looked at the history of the rise of definitions of religion, when religion becomes an intellectual category that people use, and how they use it in different ways. So I've thought a lot about sort of comparative issues around religion. And when I came to Mormonism, I think because I was an outsider to the tradition, brought questions from other experiences of other kinds of religions that I think shed different kinds of light on it. You know, it's taken me a long time to get up to speed on some of the insider knowledge, and I'm still learning lots of things as I go along. But it's really been interesting for me. Like Margaret, I'm a comparativist in a sense. So when I think about Mormonism, I think about how Mormons handle sort of general kinds of categories that people in religious studies think about, like ritual, leadership, institutions, religious experience, and try to help make sense of those things for readers and for students.
Oh, love it. Thank you for being on. You're at Washington University in St. Louis now, after a long career at University of North Carolina.
Right. Oh, right. I forgot to tell you where I am now. That's right.
Yeah. Well, no, I just wanted to make sure we knew that, because I think a lot of people know you from North Carolina. I know John Charles Duffy was a student of yours. Have there been any other Mormon scholars that perhaps my group might know that you were a mentor of there?
Reed Nielsen was my student.
Yo, for sure, man. And he just got a big promotion.
He did.
Yeah.
I joke with him that I taught him everything he knows, but not true.
Yeah, Reed's everyone's, I'm not sure, but he's basically right at the top as a co-director of the church's history department now.
Right.
So.
Right. I have another LDS student coming along, Stan Thane. So he is going to be a PhD within a year or so, I hope.
Oh, fun. And you helped organize the sessions at AAR for quite a while on Mormonism. Are you still doing that, or have you finished that?
I am not. I'm no longer on the steering committee, but I was on that steering committee for a number of years.
But you're on a board. Is it either Journal of Mormon History or Dialogue?
I'm on several, both. I'm on the board, Dialogue's board. I'm also on the MHA board, and I'm president-elect of MHA.
Oh, that is right. Ooh. I remember that now. So, gosh, what a star you are. Thank you so much for engaging us, and then in general, and being willing to come on this little fun show.
I'm a student like everyone else. That's all I do.
I sure enjoyed meeting you 10 years ago at Sunstone, and like I say, I've been trying to watch, and always my ears perk up when you do stuff, so thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
All right, you guys, I'm just going to turn you guys loose on, here are the definitions of religion that I like to play with when I start a course on religion or worldview or the construction of identity or anything that has religious themes related to it. So, Doe, can I, while you're still in good voice, start with you first?
Sure.
Like, what are some favorite, like, substantive definitions and functional definitions? You know, what is religion? What does religion do? Anything like that? And then we'll just kind of have either of you either jump in to echo or amplify or just wait your turn and hopefully there'll be some things for you to say too, but I just want to kind of spitball some broadening right now.
Yeah. Well, for me, I really like the analytical approach, which basically looks at the ways in which religion gets articulated in a society, what it looks like, how it works. Some cross between that and a functionalist approach that is concerned with, you know, what it does, what religion does for people, because I really care about, and we can think about Mormonism or, you know, any religion, how does it bring people together? I mean, that's what it does, right? It brings people together. It creates communities. It conveys identities. It creates through the values that it kind of codifies and then, you know, continues to perpetuate in the community. It creates social controls. It explains how the world works why the world works the way it does, and it provides its members with a cohesive worldview. And I always start in my classes with identity. What is it? How does it get conveyed through religion? Of course, that also brings up the question of what's the difference between religion and culture, which is a valuable conversation to have or debate to have, because a lot of things that we like, for instance, I mean, because this always comes up for me in my women in religion classes, and it's coming up now in my ritual, symbol, and myth class, female genital cutting or female genital mutilation, whatever you want to call it, and the question of cultural relativity versus, you know, cultural maladaptation. Mm-hmm. And students always want to claim that that's just culture. It's not religion. And mm-hmm. then I want to pose the question, how can you tell the difference? Because those kinds of practices are always built around the question of morality or an issue of morality. And whenever we're talking about morality, that's usually a religious conversation, right? So identity is really big. How religions adapt, so adaptation and assimilation, and of course that's a really big one for Mormonism and other new or, you know, emerging religions. Let's see what else. Location is everything, right? And in the case of Mormonism, it's different when you're located in Utah or if you're located in Louisiana.
Right. And temporal location too, ancient times.
Yeah,
versus,
yes, and time. Yeah. That's the other thing because, you know, well, like with, as Margaret, well, as all of you know, I'm sure, you know, both a few miles and 50 years in medieval Europe could, you know, determine whether or not you lived or died as a heretic or a witch.
Mm. Yeah.
Right. So,
true.
I mean, time and location are everything. Let's see, what else? I don't have my list with me, but those are the
categories. Yeah, definitely. It's just huge.
Actually, that was a great list of things, though.
That's what I'm interested in.
Yeah. Pick up, Margaret.
Well, let me go ahead because, you know, I when I teach a class in, you know, religions, whether it's ancient or modern, I also like to get the class thinking about, you know, all different ways of approaching religion and try to bring up all the issues that Doe did. I tried to come up, as Dan asked us this question beforehand, kind of a short, you know, way of saying it, and I wrote this down: organizes individual lives and identities and social groupings on the basis of worldview by the creation of doctrine, ritual, moral codes, taboos, and material objects and places. Which, and as I was thinking about that, and your definition was even better, Doe, because you connected more. But then I was thinking about some of the traditional definitions about where religion comes from, where you deal with the issue of awe and mystery or grace or the sense that there's something in the world.
Yes, the numinous.
And, right, the sort of humanist, which is not popular anymore. It's much more popular to talk about, you know, the function, the identity, you know, how it relates to culture and history and all of that, which I love. I'm a scholar,
sure.
Right? But when we get back to the personal, one of the things I have to ask myself is, why do I still have an inclination to believe on some level? I'm certainly not a true believing Mormon, but what is it that still draws me to religion or to spirituality or to something? And then I go back to that for me, there's a mystery in the world. And so, you know, so that's sort of the personal. So as the scholar, I would say exactly what you did, Doe. But then as a person who has experienced a lot of different things, why do I still have a sense of mystery? You know, am I just a hopeless romantic?
Yeah, and at least religion has done the most work to try to have expansive language, at least in that realm or in that area or that aspect of life, right? At least there, they've done the most work, and it's at least a place where it's fair game to talk about it, where maybe it isn't in the secular.
Right, even though it can get complicated, because I also think that religion can cut off that conversation too, which we see all the time in Mormonism, I believe. But it cuts off the conversation about that you know, those kind of the interiority, which as an individual is important to me.
Right, because it's more about beliefs. Yeah, it's more about beliefs, what you can declare, you know, et cetera, that you're having the correlated type of experiences rather than...
Right, yeah. But your actions and your stated beliefs, and you're going to line up and you're going to obey and you're going to do certain things. But, you know, so again, I mean, I'm not connected to any church now, but why do I still have yearnings?
Gorgeous.
So I don't know. I think that's an important part of it, even though as a scholar, I want to emphasize all the functional and, are, you know, the things that you want to articulate and how is it expressed that Doe talked about.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Laurie, what's missing from what we've said so far about a basic introduction?
Nothing's missing. I think Doe and Margaret have said a lot of great things. I think probably what I would have to add to it is I was just thinking about it in terms of my own perspective on some of these things that I'm often accused of. Some people separate historians into lumpers and splitters, meaning on the one hand, people who either lump things together and say, oh, look how similar all these things are, or people who split categories and want to point out the particularities of each thing. And I fully admit that I'm much more of a splitter than a lumper. And I tend to sort of revel in the messiness of religion, that even though religions try religious authorities do create systems, and human beings work on sort of creating meaningful systems and meaningful explanations in their world, there's so much that's sort of messy and fractured and not quite complete ever about religion. And so for me as a historian, that's what fascinates me, is how people blend things together that don't necessarily seem to go together, or create something new out of an older system, or sort of mess up the kinds of ways that we try to order our world. And I say that not to say that meaning is a bad thing or that it's wrong, but I just, as a historian, I think when you look at things like religion and politics, which is one of my areas of interest, or religion and culture, I'm fascinated by the way that individuals and groups try to fit their sort of ideals, their religious ideals, into sort of practical day-to-day realities that don't always match up neatly.
Yeah.
So that's
I'm with you. I'm the messiness person too.
I also like messy. And in fact, to me, one of the fascinating things is this tension between, if you look at the actual reality of people's lives, as you just said, Lori, it's messy. But there's also a way in which, if they're part of a tradition like Mormonism, they want to feel like that they're actually fitting in.
Right.
And I think that interesting tension between the real messiness of what people do and believe, and, you know, what they kind of actually, maybe more what they enact, and what their lives reveal, versus how they see themselves also fitting into this more regulated system. I think that tension is very fascinating, because it's always there.
And you know,
outsiders look at Mormonism and say, oh, you know, you're a bunch of, you know, you're all alike, or there's such a monolithic thing to it, but it's not true at all. You know, if you actually look at it closely, it's very messy in terms of even what people say they believe in Sunday school. I mean, I can't believe the things you can hear in Sunday school, right?
Right, right. Well, that's what's, in some ways, that's what makes it wonderful to study, but also makes it so painful for people, is
yes,
the feeling that they can't match up to whatever they consider the ideals to be, or the you know, the perfect way of being Mormon. So it goes back to what Margaret was saying about sort of both the pain and the pleasures of religion.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that's interesting is, as scholars, you also, we like the messiness, because it certainly matches at least, you know, what we find in the data. But we're dealing with a phenomenon that, for the most part, is trying to tame the chaos, that is trying to give a coherent vision. And it has founding myths, and it's got ideals and all the different things that Doe kind of talked about at the beginning, that are basically trying to say the world is the opposite of being a mess. So,
but you know what that is it's all about authenticity. So no matter where you fall in that messiness, no matter what your story is and how it aligns or doesn't align, all of us and everyone still tests our identity, our choices, and our beliefs against those standards of authenticity.
Right.
And we can find ways to win. I mean, you know, it's cherry picking the scripture. It's, you know, we can find an authorization to make what we believe authentic.
Very interesting.
I agree with you, Doe, but don't you think there's a place in terms of, you know, not just Mormonism, but other groups, where you can, you know, redo the story, you can redo the identity so that
right.
you have a place, but where is the point where, if you say it out loud, it will be seen as too different, and, you know, maybe you won't have experience like I did, that you're excommunicated, but
right.
that you're seen as marginal in some way.
Where, oh, absolutely.
So, I mean, I think that we try to make meaning, but when does it not work?
When we can, you know, when we start to be able to live with ambiguity, you mean?
Well, I think you can do that on an individual level, that, you know, I think as a person grows, and if they're really struggling, they can often learn to live with ambiguity.
Right.
But can the community deal with that, I guess, is my question.
No. Yeah. Well, that doesn't mean just because your standards of authenticity work for you doesn't mean that, you know, they're going to work for you know, the Westboro Baptist Church or yeah, whatever.
Yeah. You know? Now, you guys took what I was arguing about religion wanting to tame it, you know, tame the chaos. You took that to the individual level. But would you sort of agree that the founders of most traditions, those who kind of at least had the initial energy, part of the reason was is because we're saying we're going to give you the answer out of a bunch of different kinds of answers. And so it is that it's trying to tidy up what is naturally messy.
It also begs the question of how does religious change happen, right? Because nothing stays the same. And so how, and this is, I guess, particularly important right now in Mormonism, but in all other religions too. I mean, in the Roman Catholic Church, how does change happen? And it happens through agitation of some kind or another.
But even there's another kind of change. I mean, if you think about, back to your point, Dan, about the, you know, founders of different traditions or groups or whatever, you know, there maybe there's a level on which they want to tame it and make it orthodox. But it seems as though there's something about the nature of stories that often keeps it from doing that. So even if you think of like the first vision and all the arguments about, you know, why are the many different versions, are they inconsistent or not? Can you reconcile them? And then you think about your own life and memories that you have and stories that you tell and the versions of those stories and why you tell them differently to different audiences. And I think it's very hard to create total consistency.
Oh, sure.
I mean, even in sounding myths, it's very hard to have everything line up.
Totally.
And that's not a goal for all religions either. I think Mormonism is, in fact, at sort of one end of a spectrum in terms of having a very powerful and institutional structure, as is Roman Catholicism, I guess. But there are lots of religions where change over time is sort of taken into account in different kinds of ways.
Yeah.
It isn't as much of a focus on retaining the sort of some founding ideal in quite the same way. So, I mean, religions, that's what's so interesting about comparing religions is you see the different ways that they deal with change, with notions of truth itself, what constitutes truth, how one, you know, works towards a truth. Do you need sort of an authority structure to tell you how to live your life or to what path to take? Or is that something that comes about internally from different kinds of discernment or enlightenment?
Right. Pushing towards experience. And that's what matters rather than truth claims. You know, it's your own
In fact, an example that I can think of that goes along with what you just said, Lori, is the whole rabbinic tradition of Mishnah commentary, where you have a scriptural, you know, a text, you know, the sacred text, but then it's perfectly acceptable to not just make commentaries, but you're almost in the, you know, the Mishnah tradition, you're adding to the story in a way that has a sort of canonic value to it as time goes on. So it's not static. And I really love that idea, the notion that interpretation becomes a way of extending the sacred story to fit a new context and a new world that needs to think about it in a different way.
Yeah, and that does it explicitly, whereas, like Doe said earlier, we're all doing it all the time anyway. We just don't have as conscious.
Right, whether we know we're doing it or not.
You know, we haven't embraced it as warmly, even though we're doing it. We claim that it stays the same, but absolutely it doesn't. Hey, I want to do a couple of other things on the 101, you know, intro religion way. Just introduce the idea of the different methods for studying religion and how they each can kind of yield something different. I don't know how much we want to do, but for instance, those of you guys who are teaching religion are obviously sometimes using anthropology as a lens, you know, for illuminating ritual, for instance, or kinship systems and communal things and things like this. Other times you're looking at psychological things for some of the functional definitions of the religion too. Then there's all the hermeneutics of feminism and gender and class and economics and all those different things. What do you guys find First of all, what methodologies have I missed here that you guys really like? And how do you teach this to your students that, like, no matter what you're going to do, you're never going to be able to, you know, I guess I'm looking for, what is each method? How do you integrate all these different methodologies that come to different conclusions and sort of get your students to feel good about, the mess that's left when they all don't intersect perfectly?
Well, this is Doe. One of the things that I don't think I heard you say was material.
Okay. Oh, yeah, material religion. Culture and stuff. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, material culture. That's something that's always been really fascinating and important to me in my own studies. But usually what I've been using for quite a few years now is a pop culture approach. Even in my Witchcraft and Heresy in Europe class, I have them, you know, they're studying the medieval and early modern periods in Europe. But I want them to know that those concerns about witches and witchcraft and heretics and heresy have not gone away. And that in the U.S. and in all around the world, people are still concerned with witches and witchcraft and heresy and heretics. And so I have them do some news analyses of current, you know, issues around witchcraft and or heresy. I have them do one of each. And then at the end, they have to do a project on modern concerns about those issues as they occur in popular culture. And I've had some really fascinating, projects on homosexuals as heretics, Pope Francis as a heretic, you know, witches and witchcraft in film and in literature. And I've just had all kinds of fascinating projects. And so even in a class like that, because I'm not trained as an historian, I do care mostly personally about what's going on today, what people are doing today. And it really blows students out of the water because they never knew that witches were still being burned in Africa and other parts of the world. So it really opens their eyes.
Cool. Other methods from anybody?
I just a quick response to Doe. I mean, the whole controversy over Harry Potter, where parents, kind of evangelical parents saying that it was evil because it promoted witchcraft. I agree with you, Doe, that helping students to see that something that feels very remote in history is still very relevant today, I find this very important in my teaching as well. So I very much think that that's important in terms of teaching.
I just
students.
Remembered a project that I got last semester on obese people as heretics.
Wow.
Which was really interesting. You know, who are the new people who are ostracized, who are demonized, who are, you know, and that was fascinating because this student did a fantastic job of showing how that works in American culture.
Awesome. Laurie, any approaches from different disciplines that you find really fruitful and fun?
Yeah, when I teach my course in Mormonism, we use all kinds of different approaches. And some of the ones you mentioned, anthropology, psychology, sociology, history, but also theology and philosophy are important. And phenomenology, which is sort of a fancy term for the kinds of things we were talking about before that deal with questions of comparing religious phenomena over time and place. So looking at certain kinds of rituals and their meaning in different contexts. But all of those things I think are really valuable. And what I try to get my students, rather than just overwhelming them with possibilities and getting them so confused that they don't know what they're doing anymore, to try to get them to see it as, you know, sort of the elephant that we're all exploring from, you know, different ways and different sides.
Good.
And that you're never going to be able to recreate the whole elephant, but we have all of these different avenues into different aspects of it.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Now, I remember when I don't know, Arizona State, which was where Doe did her training too. This was my master's thesis or my master's degree in religion. I can't remember if the teachers were teaching it or if it just was something that they covered as an approach at one time. And it was sort of this declarative statement that all religions, come to understand a fundamental problem in the world and propose a salvation of sorts. Now, don't take it too Christian salvation-y at this point. But in other words, diagnose a problem. Here's something in the human condition that isn't the way it should be. And here is a set of some ways of thinking about it, some ways of approaching it, some ways of doing things that overcome this problem, that solve it. Do you guys find that to be a helpful lens? Do you use it? What are its weaknesses? Because I have a feeling that just to an average person who begins an exploration of what is religion, they might come up with that one on their own to kind of say that, well, it's a problem and a solution, and the reason that they're different is they come up with a different problem.
Dan, you know, did you know James Ford?
Yes, Japanese scholar, Japanese religion scholar.
Yes,
sure.
Yes. He took early retirement a few years ago, and I really miss him because he had a huge impact on
I took methods from him. Yeah.
Yeah, my work. Well, I took world religions methods from him in my PhD program, and that's how he taught that class, and that's how he recommended we teach religions of the world, and that is the approach I use for religions of the world, and I really like that because it gets them thinking about salvation as something more than just, you know, it's the problem that's trying
right.
to be solved.
Yeah, so
salvation isn't just like going to heaven. It's getting off the wheel, right, of rebirth. Getting off the samsara or whatever, you know.
It's really interesting, Dan, because that's the approach I'm using in the class I teach on hell right now. So in this class on hell, I start out with the idea, I try to get them to think in terms of the question, does hell have a secular use? And so I'm trying to get them away from the false dichotomy of thinking, oh, hell is just another sign of how evil religion is because it creates afterlife punishment to get people to line up and obey, versus the sort of orthodox approach of, well, this is a revelation from God. So it's really a functional in the sense of starting with the question, why do people need hell? And so even if people stop believing in hell from a religious point of view, do we need a concept of hell or punishment or even the notion of a journey to hell and then an escape from hell? What do those stories about hell or what do images about hell tell us? What is the question that they're trying to answer? I mean, is it about human suffering? Is it about trying to work through the problem that life isn't fair, that we want somehow there to be justice? What are the questions that hell is trying to answer? And I have found the students respond to that really positively. It kind of shocks them because they'd never thought about hell as other than a religious concept. Yeah. But the idea that it's answering some basic human problems that are really hard for every culture to deal with, I think is a really good way of helping students think through, you know, this complex set of not just beliefs, but really there are stories and symbols. And I mean, interestingly, that right now in our contemporary world, most major religions have given up on hell, but hell has exploded in popular culture. Mm. Why is hell so important in popular culture?
Neat. Good stuff. Mm-hmm. So two votes that it's a helpful approach. Larry, would you think the same thing? Is that something you use or?
I certainly have used it. Clifford Geertz sort of uses sort of a one riff on this idea of religion as sort of meaning making
very good.
Approach when he talks about. Religion is something that we need when we hit the limits either of our comprehension or our physical limits sometimes. So if our body starts to give out, some we look for sort of religion as a way to give meaning to that experience. So he uses that, I think, that idea of sort of almost a conceptual way of thinking about religion as an answer to a question. And I like it. I guess for me, what it doesn't explain, and this is to say that there is no one definition that explains
it. Right, and there are limits, and I was looking for limits.
Right. You had asked about the limits of that approach. I would say the limits are that for some people, religion is not logical in the sense that it's answering a question in an intellectual sense, but it's something that they can't articulate or give words to or give sort of intellectual reason to understanding, and they resist it. And I mean, some people would resist that as a way of saying that's not at all what my religion is to me. My religion is something that can't be grasped as an answer to a question or as something in the world that is sort of a logical outcome of a problem.
Nice.
So that, you know, that's just one way in which it doesn't cover everything, but for students especially, it's a great way to get them into religion because they're already thinking beings. We hope we're trying to turn them into thinking beings, but they're already thinking about problem solving. That's what you're in college to do. So it makes sense to think of religion as sort of another set of problems that can be solved in certain sorts of ways.
Wonderful. Are you guys ready to move into another section of discussion?
Sure.
Okay. Sure. I guess
it's funny, the one little footnote here, back to hell. There's a way in which hell is about facing limits, right?
Hmm.
That it pushes you to the limit of human experience.
Uh-huh.
But I agree with you, Lori, that it doesn't explain everything. And I guess that's why it's hard to find one definition.
Exactly.
Totally. Yep.
Keeps us in business.
That's right. and makes it so interesting to me.
Yeah, yep.
I just can't master it for sure. Well, just to close this first section, then I guess this couple of things that I wanted to just, again, frame the reason for this discussion is that I think when you're inside a religion and when you haven't had the chance to really do comparative work the way that the four of us here have, I think those questions of, you know, the meaning of life, the problems that life are, the solution to life's problems, or just simply like, I need to exit this life with the right answers. You know, I need to understand it in the right way, and something in my eternal life, if you have a belief that there is, you know, an eternal life, something is at stake if I get these test questions right. That is, I think, the main approach, and what we're trying to do here, especially early on, is just say, man, there's lots of other questions you can ask about your religion and about Mormonism. You know, it functions in so many ways. So that's kind of the close to this. Now, maybe this next section, as I kind of proposed it in an outline to you guys, is it's maybe we've kind of covered it just through your own enthusiasms and stuff in this first section, but but you know, what the heck, you know, if it's not, will this belief system, you know, help me get saved? you know, why isn't that a high list of high on your list of things that you would look at when you evaluate a religion? You know, in other words, I remember, you know, my first world religions class, and at first I'm like looking at everything and saying, boy, that's a crazy origin story. You know, this Adam and Eve one sure makes a lot more sense than that. You know, and you know, I was always evaluating it from my own position of just what I had grown up and inherited at. But it didn't take too long before you could kind of just see that they all absolutely have something about the human condition that they're resonating with, they're vibrating with, and it becomes so fascinating. So I just guess I'd love each of you to take a turn, and maybe we'll just start in reverse order and go from Laurie to Margaret to Doe this time, just to kind of shake things up. But you know, what is it that that makes you excited to study religion beyond truth claims, beyond salvation claims?
Wow, just about everything. About, I guess for me, what first got me interested in studying religion was that it seems to me religion is something that brings out the very best and the very worst in human beings. And it just struck me when I first started taking classes that it was the most important thing to try to figure out or to try to understand in some way, that this is a force that is so powerful in our world for good and for ill, that to try to get a handle on it somehow. And I can't say I have, but it's certainly worth the try. It seemed really important, and I couldn't imagine what else I would study that would be more important.
Awesome.
So that's a sort of short answer to the question.
And we'll definitely look at the worst in human beings and how, you know, the overlay of religion can pump up the volume, and William James's famous quote about, you know, religion will always drive irreligion to the wall. In other words, there's a strenuous mood or something that comes up, you know, when you're a religious believer that basically, you know, motivates you far beyond somebody who, you know, doesn't have that kind of sense of spiritual rightness or whatever with them. So we can kind of work on that later. But for you, the best, one of the things you're just basically saying is the best is this, like, what more important force is there in the world? And it's hard for me to argue.
Right. And it's a force that engages all of us. It engages our bodies and our senses and our minds. And that's what, you know, when I study religion, I love to study all of those things, you know, how, not just what people believe. That seems a very limited way to think about religion, or what truth is, because that's all about what's going on in your head. It's also about what bodies do and how we use our bodies and how we think about our bodies and the practices that we take on and how we relate to other people. So there are all kinds of, just so many components to it that I guess, you know, if you're someone that gets bored easily, it's always easy to find some other thing to study in religion.
Nice. And come back for another round on this question too, if anything strikes you, Larry. Margaret, what the heck? Why are you a religion scholar, or somebody who at least does a lot of religion work?
For me, I did my undergraduate work at BYU, and my first love was always literature. So I started out as an English major. And I think the thing that first got me interested in other cultures and other religions was because I read so widely. And both as a teenager and then as an undergrad student at BYU, one of my first questions that sort of was me exploring my doubts was the question of, you know, if the church claims to be the only true church, why do I find more truth in the literature, the great literature of the world, than I find at General Conference?
Right.
And, you know, I'm more inspired by Tolstoy than I am by General Conference. And so then when I was at BYU, I wanted to start studying religion because I wanted to understand things. I wanted to know for myself. And at first, I never thought about it in terms of a career or being a scholar. I sort of gradually moved into that place. So the next step I made is that I wanted to learn Latin and Greek and Hebrew so that I could study the Bible in the original languages. Mm-hmm. So I started doing that. And then I got really interested in biblical scholarship and the whole history of how the Bible is produced. And then I got interested in Mormon history. And I happened to have a boyfriend when I was at BYU who kind of introduced me into the secret world of Mormon documents. And I met Mike Quinn and all of these people. And so it was, and I just had this hunger for it. I didn't want to be stupid about my religion. I wanted to understand it. And then eventually I realized that I could make a career out of it, right? And that it was kind of like, wow, this could be a full-time thing where I study this, all of this kind of stuff on a scholarly basis. But it really started with that, you know, personal quest and journey because I wanted to know. And I wasn't satisfied to just accept the Sunday school answer.
Yeah, that was what you just said totally resonates with my journey on it too. So thank you. Well, that's a good start. Doe, do you want to give a good start on this one, and we can do another round if we decide to?
Okay. Well, actually, I guess I have to say I was drawn into religious studies because of my own, I guess I would call it a maladaptive love affair with with Mormonism.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a convert, and in large part, that's why I'm, as a scholar, I'm interested in conversion studies and you know, what it means to convert, what is carried on and what's left behind, and what kind of, you know, hybrid creation you end up with or not, but how it changes identity essentially. And so I was raised Methodist, but I kind of threw all of that over. My parents didn't go to church. So it wasn't like this huge leap to take on something completely. And I did, but from the very beginning, like even before I was baptized, I started having run-ins with authority. Like the missionary who baptized me, he would come over with his companion, and we'd sit in the family room and hold hands while his companion sat in the living room. And eventually I got called in and blamed for this. And I had no idea what the rules were. I didn't know that there was a problem with that, you know. And so from the very first moment, I was having these run-ins with authority that were really devastating. I had some bad experiences at BYU, but I just really believed. I was a true believer. And so after years and years and years of that, and two temple marriages having to deal with the cancellation of a sealing and that threat, you know, or that terrible experience and what it makes you realize as a woman who's sealed, that you can't be sealed to anyone else and you have to, you know, get on your knees and beg for this cancellation. I just had all these negative experiences. And once we moved, we made several moves, but once we moved to New Jersey, the Princeton Second Ward, I began encountering, you know, Margaret's work. And, you know, it was right after the first round of excommunications and that I met Jana Reese. She was baptized the week before I moved into the Princeton Ward. And we were there for 9 years. By the time we left there and came here, I immediately started school. And one of the professors at ASU asked me back in my master's program, how is it you came to be doing this? And I said, oh, cheap therapy. And I really didn't see it, and, you know, truly cheaper than therapy. And it was how I worked out. You know, I mean, that's one of the main reasons why authority, power and authority, is one of the categories I want my students to look at, no matter what religion or thing we're studying. You know, I want them to see how people have to relate to each other and how they have to behave with each other and who has the power and who doesn't and in what context. And so that's how I got started in religious studies. And of course, it, like everyone else has said, it's so compelling. I'm also fascinated by the way it seeks to control bodies and the way we subject our bodies, the way we relate to material objects or not. Yeah. And it's just fascinating to me. All the messiness, I love it.
Well, I think what you just said, though, about authority, that's a great addition to our initial discussion about what religion is and does. I mean, authority is one of the things that you have to look at when you see how religion works, and not just authority in terms of hierarchical structures,
right?
But who establishes authority in terms of truth? How is that established? How are rituals, or, you know, even just things like dress codes? You know, who authorizes that and why? And why do people obey that? I mean, even the whole thing with women in, you know, LDS women wearing pants to church, it's so odd to me that on the one hand, you know, it's not as though LDS women, I mean, in regular everyday life, LDS women all wear pants. It's your, you know, your grandmother, you know, it doesn't matter what age you are at, all LDS women wear pants and they don't think anything about it. It's not, oh, I'm being, you know, there's something wrong with this. And yet the idea that there's a taboo, at least in the U.S., you know, maybe elsewhere it's different, that you're supposed to wear dresses to church on Sunday. How did that develop?
Yeah.
Why does that have authority in LDS culture? It's a very strange thing on one level.
Yeah, and divisive power. Yeah, the way to alienate from each other, too. Boy.
You know, we're going to get into some of the areas that, Doe, you were talking about, and Margaret just echoing there. We're going to do another section where those things can kind of get out of control. In the end of my part two for you guys, I asked the basic question of what else captures your imagination, and if it does, leads you to consider religion as something that can contribute to healthy, flourishing lives. So let's do the healthy, flourishing lives when religion works well, and if I can do a round with you guys on that particular question, and then kind of what we've just been talking about, we'll naturally be able to segue. Laurie, what's the best things that make it a boon to the world?
Wow. It's hard to know where to start, really. You know, there's so many elements of it that I think are life-giving to people and keep them going. I'm teaching, I think the thing that comes to mind first is I'm teaching a course this semester in African-American religion. And I had a really interesting discussion with my students just this week about why African-Americans converted to Christianity when they were brought to the Americas as slaves. Why in the world they would accept this religion of the masters, right, as part of the bargain. And so we had to deal with all the things that Christianity in a new form could do for enslaved people. Give them, you know, recreate family ties, recreate kinship that had been stolen from them. Give them a sense of community, give them a sense of meaning and value in their lives. So there are all kinds of really fundamental things that at its best religion can provide for people. Everything from, you know, answering those questions when someone's dying about what's going to happen to them after they die and how do I understand this and make sense of it, to the sort of sociological questions about, you know, why is our community enslaved, or why are we being persecuted? There are so many, I think, big and little ways that both on a sort of mundane, very mundane level, but on sort of the level of ritual and sort of the larger purpose of whole communities, religion provides a sense of value, of meaning, of an experience that seems to take people out of the lives that they're in now in some way. Helps them to transcend whatever sort of dailiness that they're encountering. So I think, you know, all of those. It also, I think, gives people strength to do things that they otherwise might not do, to be brave in certain situations if they feel like they're doing things not just for themselves, but for some other cause, some other being, some larger community. You know, it makes us, maybe in some fundamental way, it makes human beings feel like they're not alone.
Very nice. Now, in some of those things that you said, obviously secular worldviews can do some of the same thing. Besides sort of the strenuous mood, I don't know if you guys are all familiar with that concept from William James and whatnot that I kind of mentioned earlier, that religion sometimes, you know, the stakes are pretty high when you talk about quote unquote the eternal things. And therefore, when somebody is focusing on those questions and feels like they've got a satisfying answer, it maybe is even more motivating than, you know, just, you know, I'm living out of my philosophy might be, you know what I mean? Laurie, are there special things about religion that separate it from a philosophy in other ways, you know, to be this motivator, this orienter?
Well, there is no eternity unless you have some idea of something beyond this life.
Right. So if a secular person might lie there on their back on a non-light polluted night and see the Milky Way and have some sort of awesome experience, wouldn't there be some sense of, I wonder if this is all there is? Would that not qualify?
Well, so your question is whether people are naturally religious?
Well, or at least sort of open to the numinous, and and religion at least lets you play in that area.
Yeah, no, that's a question that people have asked for a long time. Are human beings inherently religious? Do those questions arise just by virtue of us being human? Or are there people who really don't think that way and who don't consider those realms? And I don't know if I have a good answer to that. I tend to think that most people do think that way and look beyond themselves and the world around them. But there are some pretty determined secularists these days who I think would take argument with that.
Oh, I agree with that. But I guess I was just trying to say, you know, you're describing things that it does for the individual. Are there things that you sense it does that a secular philosophy can't, or just a worldview that doesn't really talk about the big questions?
Yeah, I do think it takes people sort of beyond the things that they can see and hear around them. That I'm trying not to use the word transcendent,
right,
because that's also sort of limited to certain kinds of traditions. But I think it allows people to live in worlds beyond the world we see and hear and, you know, we can see with our senses or experience with our senses. And that can be a very freeing thing for people to see that there is life after death, for example, after the things that we see here and now are gone, that there's more to it than that. And those are things that secular philosophies don't admit.
Thank you. Thank you. You gave an answer that I approve of, but thank you for going along with me on pushing you down those roads. Margaret or Doe, either on that particular question that I was forming there, or just your own take on why religion contributes to flourishing, healthy lives, before we kind of talk about the negative stuff.
Well, to build on what Lori just said, you use the word courage, Lori, and I think that that's true, that sometimes, you know, the sense there can be, and not like you, obviously you can have courage in a secular sense too, but maybe there's a way in which there's a kind of power that people feel, where the notion that a sort of a spiritual power that takes you beyond yourself, both maybe in terms of courage to do things or even to face difficult situations. I mean, another word could even be the word grace. The notion that sometimes people feel that they feel endowed with a sort of grace that gives them courage to face really hard things in life.
Or to love difficult people, or all those things.
Yeah, or even the idea, or even loving yourself, right?
Yeah,
the
nice
idea that somehow you can feel like there's a force outside of you, which goes back to the notion of salvation, I guess, but not salvation in the sense of like heaven, but salvation in the sense that you could feel a grace that you're loved by a power that's larger than yourself. I think that that can be really healing for people. I think people feel healing often through religion, you know, at sometimes the darkest moments, that they have courage or power or spiritual comfort. Religion can give you comfort. It can give you healing. It can help you forgive people that you otherwise could not forgive.
And you're saying this comfort, not in terms of like the opiate of the masses, it's, you know, the tool to tamp down rebellion, you know, that kind of stuff. You're talking something beyond that.
I'm trying to talk in sort of the expansiveness of human capability.
Right. I like it.
And again, it's not like you don't see any of that in the secular world.
Sure.
You do, you know, but I think a lot of people feel that that comes from their religious sensibility. It's, they feel these things and they say, where does that come from? I felt this power that seemed almost outside of myself that I could endure, or that I could forgive, or that I could love where I didn't think I could love, or I felt loved, you know, even for myself, where I just, you know, went beyond my own ability. So this sort of sense of grace or spiritual power, I think that can be a very positive thing for people. Ben, when you first asked this also, Dan, I had to laugh because one of my first responses was, religion can give you really great art. Maybe not in the Mormon.
Yeah,
the
little kitsch art
I'm
representation.
Just thinking about how with Christmas not too long past, I love religious Christmas music, the old-fashioned religious Christmas music. I hate the sort of, Frosty the Snowman secular songs. I mean, not like there's not something good about them. But I'm just saying that, even when I think I've given up on religion, I'm amazed sometimes how I can be inspired by religious music, by Handel or by religious art. I respond very much to art. So,
nice.
Just that somehow maybe that connects with what I was saying before, that there's a way, an expansiveness that people can feel through religion that kind of pushes them toward the best.
Wonderful. Thank you. Toe, do you want to weigh in on this one?
I really love what you both said, what all three of you have said about this. But the idea of religion gives us great art, that's actually, that sticks in my mind, because Michael Malloy, in his newest edition of Experiencing the World's Religions, he actually names that as one of the things religion does for people. It gives them a source for artistic creativity, like we have great architecture, great paintings, great music and stuff. But what, that's just an aside, but I think for me, what I just follow up with what the other two have said with, I think religion is useful, is good for people in that it helps challenge the status quo. And this goes along with having courage. And it's every religion has to determine, or one of the questions that religion answers is, what constitutes a person? And how do I have to behave in relation to that person? What constitutes a non-person? And of course, various religions, and I'm not just in the U.S., but I'm an Americanist, so I'm going to talk about the U.S. We see a huge debate that religion is contributing to about, do LGBT people constitute persons?
Mm-hmm.
Or are they non-persons? And you see moderate Muslims challenging violent acts by Muslim extremists. You see Roman Catholics, not just Pope Francis, but other, just the laity challenging what have become, what's become this kind of eliding of this, forgetting of social justice issues. And so just like other religions, Mormonism itself is also going through a very painful time, having to grapple with, what does it mean to be human, and how do we need to treat each other? And I think religion has a great role to play in that. And that's not to say that one must be religious to have a sophisticated sense of ethics, but I think that's a very rich debate, I think, that's happening right now.
Awesome.
Well, in fact, one of the sort of interesting things about that whole phenomenon that you're describing, Doe, is the fact that often when you look at really authoritarian religions, whether you're looking at Catholicism in the Middle Ages or other, Mormonism right now, you have authoritarian structures, but often it's sort of a religious impulse that makes people feel the courage that they can challenge the status quo. So you have a St. Francis of Assisi, or you have, people right now in Mormonism who are willing to speak up. So that to me is really interesting, that religions can produce those kinds of reactions in a context where you might not think it would happen, where it seems so restrictive.
Right. And, I love Val Rust's work. I don't know if you've seen his work. The name of the book escapes me right now. I can look it up in a second. But he was doing genealogy and discovered that his forebears who joined the his ancestors, whose forebears, the people who came after his ancestors, who joined the LDS Church in its inception, in its early days, those forebears had been members or participants in the Radical Reformation. Mm. They were seekers. Well, the problem with seekers is that they very often don't stop seeking. So there is definitely that impulse, mm-hmm. You know. Always a seeker, I guess.
Yeah.
That's kind of reductionist, but...
So interesting, you guys.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.